We talk about Luka Doncic going scorched earth to send the Timberwolves home. What the future holds for Minnesota, specifically with Karl Anthony Towns and Rudy Gobert. And we take a early look at the matchup between the Mavs and the Celtics in next week's NBA Finals. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to a special Friday edition of No Cap Room because the Dallas Mavericks gentlemanly swept the Minnesota Timberwolves. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always in a fantastic sunshiny mood, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What is up?
Right off the bat, shouts out to Graydon Gordian, who coined the term gentleman sweep many, many blog moons ago. I feel like I search for it every year. I had to tweet out a thank you to Graydon for coming up with the term so that I could easily find it when I searched for it to figure out who came up with it. Graydon wrote about the Spurs a long time ago, and the Dallas Mavericks are now the Texas team that is invoking it. So shouts out to Graydon. Shouts out to the Mavericks. Man, we got a finals, Jake. It took a long time to get here. Actually, it didn't take very long in the conference finals to get here. It's just taken a long time this year. But now yeah. We know where we're going to be going, where we're going to be headed, and who we're going to be watching. Pretty cool stuff.
April 14th, last day of the regular season. So it's been a hike. It's been a climb. And we will talk more about the NBA Finals matchup that guarantees a sixth different champion will be hoisting the Larry O'Brien for the sixth straight year. We will talk about it all. But yeah, let's kind of sift through the rubble of the scorched earth that Luka Doncic left in downtown Minneapolis, where his final stat line of 36 points, 10 rebounds, 5 assists just like isn't going to do it justice. Because yeah. If you were tuned in from the jump, his 20 points in the first quarter absolutely blew the doors off of the Timberwolves. There was a fan apparently mocking him by throwing and tossing a handkerchief to the game from his courtside seat to mock Luka for crying to the refs all the time. And it brought me back to, I think it was game 2 in OKC of the second round, just firing all cylinders right now, me and the table setting here. And he said it then, and people have just kind of, don't f- with this guy if you yeah. want to have your team beat him. It's that Amin El-Hassan tweet. Your tears are PEDs for him. He does not give a shit if you make a lot of money enough to sit there and put your 2 feet on the wood and have the ability to say anything, because he will have the ability to put the ball in the hoop while you cannot. So my public service announcement to all of the angry Irishmen who are going to be in TD Garden for games 1 and 2. I love Boston. I love the fan base. That's where I went to school. That's where I came up in my career. Thank you to Jeff Twiss and Heather Walker for credentialing a 19-year-old intern, or else I wouldn't be talking to you right now through this camera and this microphone, Daniel Devine. But don't f- with this guy. That is my word to the maybe unwise after drinking 7 Guinnesses on Thursday, June 6th.
I mean, I feel like we've got to broaden the scope here. It's not just angry Irishmen. There's angry Cape Verdeans. There's angry Black folks. There's angry people of all shapes and sizes and colors and creeds that go to TD Garden for Celtics games. And I don't imagine they're going to take your advice. I think Luka's going to hear an awful lot of stuff. Kyrie Irving, we'll get back to that, but he's going to hear an awful lot of stuff. The Mavericks in general are going to hear an awful lot of stuff from the stands in Boston. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It doesn't seem like if it does anything to Luka, it certainly doesn't seem to get him off of his game. he came out, he heard for 2 days about how Kyle Anderson was the answer, and yeah. about how switching Anthony Edwards onto him made him uncomfortable, and about all the ways in which, you know, actually Rudy Gobert is playing pretty well in the drop coverage and all that kind of stuff. And he said, I'm just going to reduce this to ash right off the bat. Made his first 5 shots. It was 16-8 before anyone even looked around and saw what was going on. And yeah, he outscored the Timberwolves by himself in the first quarter, 20-19. And like, that was it. It was a punch directly on the jaw, and the Timberwolves never responded. I mean, it's the final score, we didn't say, I don't think we said it up top. It was 124-103, and that does not accurately depict the dominance that Dallas put on display in that game. I think the lead got as high as 36. Like, Minnesota had to go on runs to try to get it under 20, and only was briefly successful in doing so. Like, you're going to look at the final box score on this, and you'll see that Anthony Edwards and Karl Anthony Towns, I think each went for, was it 28? Or they each put up some decent numbers. Cat, I think, finished 9-for-20 from the floor. All of that happened, or almost all that happened, after this game was completely decided. Like, the first quarter of this game was Luka throwing meteors at people and Rudy Gobert getting a lot of post touches. And once that was the math, it was like, well, this is going to be a really long and really bad night for the Timberwolves. And the way I can tell that stuff is, like, I keep notes as the game's going on, because I've been doing these, like, walk up pieces. If, you know, after a game, what's going to be something to keep an eye on for next game. And in the event that this got extended to six, I wanted to have notes to reflect back on. The last note I took was with 2.5 minutes left in the second quarter. Huh. It just didn't seem. And it was, hey, Naz Reid, don't hit Derek Lively in the neck again. He is lucky he is not ejected, which, frankly, who would have known if Naz Reid got ejected, given the way he produced and the lack of impact he made on the game in game five. This was a, like, stem to stern, tip to tail, foot to ass beatdown that showed that maybe the Wolves' biggest energy exertion in the series was not getting swept, and that the Mavericks have another level to get to with their shot making and with their defense that has made them an absolutely dominant team basically since the trade deadline. This is the version of the Mavericks that they had envisioned in their mind's eye, and seeing it on this stage to get them to this point was pretty impressive.
Yeah, Kyrie was ready too. And, like,
absolutely.
The first quarter, the first half, I don't know if either he or Luka touched the rim. Like, they were just splashing. And there's been this talking point that Stan Van Gundy started through the broadcast on TNT about them being potentially the greatest backcourt in the history.
Offensive backcourt
in the history of the NBA. Of course, Draymond Green has taken offense to that in defending his Splash Brothers.
Seems out of character for him. Shocking that he would take umbrage at something like that and decide to clap back about it. Doesn't seem like him.
My thing I want to say, I don't remember a single I'm destroying the opponent and ending this series performance like this since, I forget exactly what year it was, but the LeBron game six in Boston with Miami. Was that 2013?
I think 2012.
Whatever one it was, where he's wearing the all black and his nostrils are flaring and he put up 48. Like, Luka came out. This is not really like a statistical analysis, right? I wasn't even in the building, but there's this adage in the league that has always existed, right? Of, when you have the best player on the floor, typically that just means you're going to win the series. And I remember, I've definitely said this on these airwaves, I remember being in Manila this summer when Canada and Slovenia matched up, and I was ready to see the Luka show, and Shea was the best player on the court. And to me, it wasn't even close. And there was a lot of Luka complaining to the refs. And there was even, like, in FIBA play, there's, like, this element kind of even, you are a different guy when you're playing for your high school team than your AAU team type thing, but on a national stage. And the Slovenian apparatus just is Luka. Like, his dad is part of the federation and blah, blah, blah. So, just kind of felt like he was acting a bit like the varsity quarterback in, like, the Friday Night Lights TV show that is Slovenia national team basketball. And I've just been blown away by how, even with some of the chirping and stuff that provoked this fan to bring a handkerchief courtside, which, again, do not do it, Boston. Don't do it. Just try not to. It's been amazing to watch him just be this demonstrative force. And I know there's a rush on all of the talk shows and the debate programming and whatever to like, where will Luka stand in an NBA hierarchy and whatnot and blah, 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 blah. I'm just, it's really cool that this dude is still only 24, which that's one thing for both of these matchups, for both teams in this matchup or with Boston and Dallas, that they're still pretty damn young. Sure, there's some old guys in the mix, but like, it's just cool that we have in this Game of Thrones and if all these teams and these organizations are these individual kingdoms, like, it's very similar to that program where like, it kind of even just don't have a choice. You have to hitch your wagon to someone you think is the rightful heir to the Iron Throne or the Larry O, or else you will die. And like, Luka definitely is one of the prince that was promises.
You are really stringing this one out. You might be writing these stories longer than George R.R. Martin is writing these stories.
Oh, yeah. He's just like, he's always been that dude.
Yeah.
And to like see it break through in such a way, in such a no one, you can't motherfucker and blah, 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 guard me, like all series long. And then to cap it off like this, like there's a rooting interest in my household from the two girls, my partner and our beautiful foster dog, for me to not go to Dallas on Saturday. So they were kind of not in the room when the game was started. And I said, hey, get in here. Luka's putting up one of the greatest playoff performances ever. That's how we started off. And that, it's just something I wanted to really, I don't know, put a frame around and hang it in the Louvre, to use Jaylen Brown's expression for Jason Tatum's behind the back pass. That was equally awesome in the end of game three of Indiana Conference Finals. And I end my rant there.
It was a good rant. There was a lot of twists and a lot of turns. I think the brand ended up on the Iron Throne. I'm not sure exactly how it worked out.
No, Kyrie did.
Kyrie did? Fair enough.
No, just...
Listen, the thing that struck me so often in this series was just I mentioned earlier that kind of like, this is the vision they had. Mm-hmm. You have two of these guys who can be crunch time playmakers, shot makers. Like, even if the defense does everything right, they can make you wrong. Right. And that's was the idea. You have two of these guys, one of whom in Kyrie has been, you know, an elite number two complementary option, extremely comfortable playing off the ball, shooting off the catch, being the sort of second side action initiator. And with, you know, plenty of huge game experience, including most famously making like one of the biggest shots in NBA history to win the finals.
Which feels like a lifetime ago.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it later. I mean, like, Kyrie has lived a lot of life between 2016 and today, right? And this version of him that has sort of had all those experiences sort of coalesce and come together has been everything that the Mavericks could have possibly asked for when they made that deal. It's not the offensive fit was clear immediately, but it has blossomed and developed over time. The chemistry that Luka and Kyrie have in terms of being able to work together, not just your turn, my turn, which, by the way, they do brilliantly and did brilliantly throughout that series. Like, Kyrie's 24 point first half in game one, Luka's 15 point fourth quarter, right? Kyrie goes for 13 to open up game two. Luka's the one with the step back game winner in game two. Luka in the third in game three, Kyrie in the fourth. Luka with 20 to open the game last night. Kyrie with 15, doesn't miss a shot in the second, and the game's over before halftime. Like, they have developed this counter, you know, sort of countervailing rhythm, you go, I go, but they've also been able to work together more easily. Like, there was a play last night where when they finally gave up the ghost, the Wolves on, like, we can drop back. We've got to start blitzing Luka. We got to start trying to get the ball out of his hands near the end of the first quarter. And the first possession they had of that, Kyrie was stationed a couple of passes away from the ball. So Luka's got to get the ball to Gafford in the middle of the floor. Next pass, sort of swing, reset, get Luka another chance to attack downhill, winds up in a lob for a Gafford dunk. But the next time down, Dallas with the smarts, with Jason Kidd on the sideline, but also the way Luka and Kyrie can diagnose in real time and problem solve, they just stationed Kyrie one pass away from Luka. So if you're bringing that help, you're bringing the second guy, you're bringing him off of frigging Kyrie Irving.
And he can sidestep and loft a moon ball over any fucking closeout imaginable. I know I'm cursing a lot, but I'm sorry. I'm just gassed up by Dallas.
That's it's completely reasonable. And like the second that help starts to go, Kyrie understands this and goes like, I'm not waiting. Like as soon as my guy shades off of me and is over by the nail, it's a slot cut. I'm moving full speed into a catch. Luka gets off the ball. Easy catch, easy run, floater. I mean, not an easy floater for many guys, but, you know, Kyrie's been making those in his sleep all season and certainly all postseason. Like, they have so many ways to make you wrong. And you have that combination, the way that they're dovetailing together, the way they can spell one another, and that defense with the size and the physicality, the athleticism. Like, it is a recipe for success that has been among the most consistent in the playoffs. And also down the last, month and a half, couple months of the season, they got healthy, they got big, and they got Luka. And that is, like, the Celtics will be favored in this series, understandably so, valid reasons for that. Celtics could absolutely wind up just stamping their dominance and saying, like, turns out we were that team all along. But they are going to have to beat an exceptionally good Mavericks team that knows exactly who it is and exactly how to make those strengths felt on a night-to-night basis. And man, if you're not so sure about that, just ask the freaking Timberwolves.
Let's talk about the Minnesota Timberwolves, who Anthony Edwards said in his post-game press conference, will be back. And look, this is just the nature of the league. There is no guarantee the Timberwolves will be back. They haven't been back in 20 years.
Of course.
I want them to be back. I want everyone to be back. I want all the success for all the people. It just doesn't work that way. The Denver Nuggets thought they'd be back, at least in the conference final stage. And they lost to these Minnesota Timberwolves. And I mean, the margins are so thin, especially as we continue to drift deeper into the more tumultuous, stormy waters of the second apron era, which is exactly where the Minnesota Timberwolves' current payroll is expected to be, provided they don't make pretty critical change. And that's the big ticket, most gossipy rumor mill headline of all this. But to me, it just is the accounting, the economics that every single NBA team has to be wrestling with this summer and the smartest teams were preparing for previously and thinking about, well, if we don't win and if this doesn't max ourselves out, like how do we pull certain levers to get under the punitive second apron threshold if we don't necessarily believe that this team is worthwhile? Currently, I'm sitting here on Friday, May 31st, thinking that it will be worthwhile and is worthwhile, being that the taste that will be left in many a Minnesotan's mouth from this gentleman sweep that we've been discussing will be far more sour, I think, than what the overall big picture of what this team was. And there's so much nonsense hanging over everything from an ownership battle where you've got John Krasinski at The Athletic reporting that Glenn Taylor was trying to shake the hands of A-Rod and Mark Lowry and even give them hugs at these games, and all those overtures were rebuffed. And then you've got this long-standing belief around the league, and like it just kind of is what it is, that A-Rod and Mark Lowry were the faction of the ownership group that wanted to go out and get a marquee name to be the architect of this roster to lead their basketball operations, not Glenn Taylor, so that there's this mutual opt-out clause in Tim Connelly's contract that, look, if the quibbling continues between these ownership factions, like, Glenn Taylor is still going to be the majority owner while the offseason happens if they're still battling in court. Like, the organization still keeps running. They don't just get to put pause on things and the whole NBA stops to wait to figure out which billionaire, you know, group here wins this petty battle. So, like, there's a ton of tectonic plates that are going to be determining how all this stuff unfolds, let alone like what you think should happen, Dan. However, where do you personally stand on what this team just accomplished a year after the Rudy Gobert trade was widely mocked? And then he became the defensive player of the year again. They were fighting for the one seed all year long. They knock off the defending champs and then fall short in the conference finals.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I keep... Well, first off, does A-Rod need to go check with the Iron Bank of Bravos? Is that what needs to happen? Does he need to, you know, to see if exactly. he can get a loan there?
He's got to sail through the... What's the snake thing where if you get bit, you get the
oh, grayscale. You know what, man? Old Valyria. I don't know. I'm a nerd, but I'm not that. I'm not a specific nerd about this. I'm not a book reader nerd. I'm a watch the show nerd. Anyway, I mean, I have read books before, just not these particular books.
I'm reading Salem's Lot right now by Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And the breadth of how he's like built out all these characters has been a masterclass, and it's made me think of Thrones, actually, like just how you keep track of all these different little pawns in the greater chessboard. But yeah, please continue. Yeah.
I forget how to read during the playoffs. Mostly just reading.
It helps me go to sleep. Helps me go to sleep.
Sleep. What a beautiful thing sleep is. What was I going to say? You talked about how thin the margins are, and obviously, like you referenced it in terms of the roster building and the financial needle that they're going to have to thread, and you know the big decisions that come on that. Like, is Karl Anthony Towns going to wind up on the trade block because you've got to figure out how to retrofit this roster moving forward around Anthony Edwards, and also, you know, with Karl Anthony Towns, I believe the figures are like $11 billion coming up on his contract. Like, you know, what's the market for him going to be? Anyway, I keep going back to how slim the margins are in these games, right? Like, they got their doors blown off in Game 5. They won Game 4. They finally won a crunch time game in the series. But before that, it's, you know, they're up with 3.5 minutes to go in Game 1, right? They're up, you know, heading into the final possession of Game 2 or final 10 seconds of Game 2. And then Luka hits that rip your heart out of your chest, step back three, where he's got Rudy Gobert on skates. They're up in the final 5 minutes of Game 3. Like these so much before they completely just like disintegrate in terms of crunch time execution. This, which was a problem all year long for the Timberwolves. Like this was a team that won on the strength of its defense, but that consistent and had like around a league average offensive efficiency for most of the season, but that consistently struggled in close and late situations, that really struggled with its collective decision-making, especially when Mike Conley was off the floor, when he was off the ball, that forced Anthony Edwards to kind of have to level up his ability to read defenses, read through coverages, and get complementary guys involved or break through the wall if his teammates were not being guarded. And this was, you know, he slammed into that wall in this series. You know, Ant will, like, I think the larger discourse is going to be like, well, Towns was, you know, wasn't very good for a few games. And Rudy, can you really win with him being the offensive sort of liability that he is? And then also the way he can get exposed defensively, which is always sort of an unfair thing, but whatever. If Anthony Edwards makes like more than half of his shots in the restricted area in this series, maybe we're singing a different tune, right? If Anthony Edwards doesn't have multiple kind of backbreaking turnovers late in quarters, and also like heading into that final 10 seconds, 12 seconds of Game 2, you know, maybe we're singing a different tune. If Naz Reid makes that three at the potential buzzer beating game winner in Game 3.
It was in and out, man.
In and out. You know, like maybe what is the Al Pacino thing from Any Given Sunday? The inches we need are everywhere around us. And they lost all of those inches for the first three games of this series. And now that's what puts you in the existential crisis. So Anthony Edwards is, I think, he's obviously, it was a remarkable postseason run for him. Where he can go is, you know, the sky is the limit for him. But this is like all of the accolades and the plaudits that he got for the first two rounds. This was the, you know, coming back to earth a little bit in the third round. And there's been plenty of elite players who have run into that wall themselves and had to figure out a way to either break through it or climb over it. This will be what he needs to do head moving forward. But yeah, I think there's no, like, I reject in general the principle of like, if you don't wind up being the one team that wins at the end, that season was a disappointment or a failure. It's harder to hold to that stance when you just got the absolute shit kicked out of you in an elimination game on your home court. That is a more difficult pill to swallow and a heavier burden to bear. But if you are a Timberwolves fan, you got more joy this season than I think that team has collectively in aggregate given you in two decades. And that's got to be worth something. Otherwise, what the hell are we here for? So I think
tell that to Sacramento, even though much different scale of success.
But absolutely. All right. I mean, talk to me in 12 months. And if the Wolves don't build on this, then yeah, I can understand feeling frustrated about that. If the Wolves wind up in some kind of weird contract stalemate with Chris Finch and don't want to pay him, and then there's leaked out reporting about whatever his competitive offers are made for him, like, yeah, then maybe the vibe will be a little bit different around Minnesota. But you don't have to give back the joy they gave you because it ended in flames, right? So I feel like when I will step back and take a look at this Wolves season, I won't think like, well, it wasn't quite enough to be worth the luxury tax outlay. I'll think like that was the best team of that franchise I've seen, period. And it delivered for that fan base in a way that nobody has since Kevin Garnett was at his absolute peak. So it ends in disappointment. I hope that there's a halo, sort of some sort of, as you step back, a sort of halo for the fans there. But what comes next, it's going to be very, very tricky for them to move out of this financial situation. If it's me, I think it's worth it for them to whoever is owning the team to pony up and pay up and let's see where this team, some minor tinkering around the edges on the playmaking and maybe some more shooting to open up the floor for Ant, where that gets you. But, easier said than done. Everybody's looking to make those around the edges improvements, and they don't come cheap.
I think the last thing to say about this subject before we hit a little finalsy talk is this is what all these teams are hoping to do. You are hoping to get multiple all-stars, get them all paid and under long-term team control. And that's not the case for Rudy Gobert's contract and Mike Conley's contract and what have you. But like, these dudes are all pretty locked up. When you look at the young group of, and Kat's not a spring chicken anymore, but he's still in his prime. Kat, Ant, Naz Reid, Jaden McDaniels, that group is all locked in for at least two more years across the board.
I thought Kat's 28.
He's 28.
The bar for not a spring chicken anymore. It makes me feel like, again, my face is melting off my body and I'm going to shrivel into a corn cob and go under this desk. But yes, you're absolutely right. The other guys say that all locked up long term.
How much more do you expect him to grow and flourish from where he is now?
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe some, auxiliary limb control exercises come the off season, like learning how to take better control of the far arc chair. Although they're far away from him. I understand, like, it's hard to control stuff that's far away from you. Here I am flapping. You can't see it on the camera, but I am flapping.
Yeah, I don't know what it's like to be 7 feet tall. But this group had that fun run with the play-in win, and then they had a 2-1. Right? Series lead on Memphis, whatever.
They were up on Memphis run
against
before.
Memphis.
Yeah.
That ultimately they got rebounded into oblivion. That's what provoked the Rudy Gobert trade.
Yeah.
But like last year, Naz Reid and Jaden McDaniels not there. Like this was kind of the first real run of this group. And there's all this, it's like an ineffable aspect of the expectations that loom over a franchise when you kind of, like where you land at the finish line or the final pole or whatever, compared to what your expectations were, compared to what they could be. When I was in Indiana for games 3 and 4, there was so much, especially after they lost game 3, there was so much talk and just stuff in the air about like, oh, we don't want to be Atlanta from 2021 and I think even to the point where like, the word might be like, I think Pacers GM Chad Buchanan said something to this effect in his exit interview about like, don't let this be the expectation that we're here every year. Cause like, it's pretty hard to get back here.
Sure.
To me though, like the Wolves weren't necessarily, sure, you make that trade for Rudy Gobert to like put yourself in the top tier of the West, but I don't think this team has had as championship or bust expectations as others in the league. Like Boston falling short of the finals would have been, who knows how catastrophic that could have been.
Right.
Like, does Joe, this is just me throwing a total spitball out there, but like, does Joe Mazzulla keep this job if his 2 years on the job, he, you know, for whatever reasons of who the blame would have been, who, like, what he, the expectations are to make the finals and win it. This team's been in this mix, but also to the same side of this coin, like Boston getting to the finals, so the conference finals so early in 17 with these guys, and then 18, Jason Tatum's rookie year, like it just kind of set the tone for this team to be at this threshold forever. That type of stuff, I think, is just important to consider when thinking about what decisions ultimately will be made. And to me, I just want to remind everyone that like this was kind of year one of all these dudes being healthy and together for the playoffs, being that McDaniels punched a wall and broke his hand and Nas was out and blah, blah, blah. So plus like Mike Conley was a late addition last year.
Yep.
Like he had a full year, and I know there's questions in our rundown about how effective can a 37-year-old Mike Conley really be. I don't know. All these dudes are playing until 40 now. So, and he wasn't the squeaky wheel. Sure, there's defensive issues and matchup hunting and what have you, but like, I don't know. There, to me, there's enough to believe in. Sure, will Cat's name get bandied about on the trade market because there's at least, at a minimum, plenty of rival teams who would like that to be the case? Of course. But for now, I am stamping my claim on the side of history saying, run this back. So that's all I got.
Here, man. Hey, rich people of Minnesota, whoever needs to kick into the kitty to make it all happen, get this ownership deal situated, do that. Keep paying these guys because what they produced this season was worth investing in. And then, you know, if it all goes, you know, belly up next year, then whatever, then you make the decisions you need to make from there. But what they did this season deserves to be celebrated, and what they produced deserves to be explored further to see, you know, like if you can put some more guys on the floor that can make shots, that, you know, Dallas doesn't have to like not guard three of them in a closeout game. You know, who knows where you can go from there.
And like Rudy's only on the books through 25-26. So you get your 2 years in the second apron and then you get out. They have an opportunity to keep this thing together, sacrifice the year-to-year team building issues where you won't be able to have your tax pyramid level and you won't be able to aggregate salaries and whatever, which does suck. But you have this team, you have this core already. So can you rely on your scouting department and get a couple minimums and blah, blah, blah? And then after the 25-26 window goes through, you kind of scale things back spending wise and you can dodge the second apron for 3 years and not have your picks frozen, all that type of stuff. We'll talk more off-season questions and big picture stuff later, and we will talk more NBA finals after we take a quick ad break. Welcome back to No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. The NBA's finals start almost a full week away next Thursday. So we'll have plenty of time to preview the series from every angle as the days go along. But I just wanted to hit on a couple of quick things that are going to be top talking points. And they're things that have already come up in my group chat with not the Philly friends, with my three friends from my fraternity that were still in touch, that we do four plus me, five of us, where we draft teams every year for a wins pool, like snake draft, and I've never won. So shows how much I know about the league that I cover, but they're all Celtics fans pretty much to a man. So they're pretty jazzed up and they think this is going to be an easy series, which I'm not ready to go that far. Actually, I'm very bullish on Dallas's chances here. But anyway, they play twice this season. Boston won both, only once since the trade deadline on March 1st. Daniel Gafford only played 6 minutes off the bench. Derek Jones only played 7 minutes off the bench. Obviously, much different makeup now where both those guys are starting. And I don't really know what we can really glean from that game. I'm sure, look, Joe Mazzulla talked about watching the Pacers without Tyrese Halliburton when he got hurt for sustained a hamstring injury before Pascal Siakam was acquired to pick up some things, and they learned, and then TJ McConnell became part of their scouting report. So I'm sure, cannot confirm, but my belief would be that the Celtics are watching that film, even though it's a different team.
Joe Mazzulla made a point of telling everybody that they were going to weaponize their time before between the end of their series and the start of the finals. So you got to find other, you know, if you're looking for weapons, you know, you turn over every rock and you know, look in every darkened corner of the room. So I'm sure that in between viewings of the town, you found some time to break down that tape.
I'll just say this too. Like, Joe Mazzulla is a weirdo. He just is. Not many people in the league seem to with him, but
wow, okay.
That's just what it is. But I left the conference finals pretty taken by how that whole roster has really fallen for how he preaches the game, and from like a mindset standpoint, and the principles that he has like sewed into the fabric of that team, to the point where, like, when I was sitting there post game, game four, thinking about how Brad Stevens, from all my book reporting, trying to figure out the early days of him in Boston, how like the players were, I mean, very different personalities and very different approaches, but the players were all just kind of taken to how the attention to detail that he would bring to practices and whatnot. And he would run all five guys through all five positions, so everyone knew every aspect of every action and blah, blah, blah. Like, the word when Ime Udoka got suspended, and that this is a completely unplanned riff, and that Joe Mazzulla was like the obvious choice to Brad Stevens, was pretty strong. Like, hearing Derek White shout out these like championship stations that they do at practice, which is literally like out of a high school training camp where the players rotate around all the baskets and side baskets on the court. Most NBA facilities have two courts side by side and have as many as two or three baskets along the baseline. So you get like 8 to 12-ish hoops around the practice court, and they're doing out of bounds plays and what, like, just wanted to say, I saw some talk in the early Twitter sphere, like trying to break down this matchup, and some people saying like, oh, the Mavs have the best player and the coaching advantage. Like, A, I don't know enough. I don't think anyone who's not on these coaching staffs and that doesn't work on a coaching staff knows enough to tell you who's like truly better. But like, Joe Mazzulla, for all the shit he's gotten to from Celtics fans and whatnot, for the late game offense not having as much direction that people would like, dude's a damn good coach, and he's gotten those dudes to believe in all of his messaging and mindset stuff and what have you. So just quick shout out to Joe Mazzulla. Anyway, who is going to grab the crown this year? 26-year-old Jason Tatum or 25-year-old Luka Doncic? To go to what we were saying earlier, Dan, it's just cool that two guys who have been anointed as like next, you know, like, to go back to Minnesota for a second, like, until Ant breaks through, he will have kind of this same type of monkey on his back type thing put on him by the national media. To me, this feels more like Luka's playoff run than Tatum's, but they're dealing in much different contexts. Tatum has a six-man super team, and Luka has a very tailored pecking order behind him, a very complimentary pieces and stuff. So to me, that's like he is wearing the cape far more than Tatum has been, to the point where you could argue about who should have been Eastern Conference Finals MVP, but Jaylen Brown got it. So like, Luka was unanimous.
Yeah.
The voting stuff is always funky, and Andre Iguodala will tell you otherwise, but yeah, to me, this just feels more like this. We will look back on this playoff run as like Luka's play, even if they lose. Like, I feel like this was more of his hero story than Jason Tatum's hero story.
I think it depends a lot on how the finals unfold. I mean, really hot take there. to this point, yeah, I mean, this is like, it hasn't felt maybe I'm just sort of oblivious and head in the sand on this. It hasn't felt to me like the overwhelming, overarching narrative of the last, you know, month and a half of basketball is like Luka Doncic arising and, you know, ascending to the throne. It hasn't felt like that's the story of the playoffs. It is the story that we find ourselves with now because of A, like what he just did to tear apart. Like, and then you sort of, you step back and you're like, well, they beat the number one seed in the West. They beat the number one defense in the West. And he has like ripped the hearts out of these teams in these games to do it. And you, the sort of, again, zoom further out and take the 10,000 foot view, as our pal Tom Haberstroh noted on his newsletter, his Substack this morning. Luka is on track to lead this postseason in points, rebounds, and assists. That's only been done one time before, and it was last year, and it was Nikola Jokic in the course of having this same narrative run, right? Of like, this is where I now take over and as the best player in the world. Luka is averaging more than 28 points, 9 rebounds, and 8 assists per game in this playoffs. The only other guys who have ever done that in a postseason where they played at least 10 games, Jokic, LeBron, and Oscar Robertson. Like, this is, he is in the midst of an historic run and enters this series as, I think, the unquestioned best player in it, the most overwhelming force in it, the guy who is best capable of sort of just grabbing a game by the scruff of its neck and making it do what he wants. He has broken two top five defenses in the last two rounds. And really, like, it was a masterpiece of what he can do with the way he controls the game. If he's making threes and the step backs are going, and he's also now more willing to get off the ball and take and make catch and shoot threes, which is, you know, always that thing we've said about Harden forever was the difficulty for him. Luka has adapted and embraced that, being able to play more off of Kyrie and being able to play more off of, if I get off the ball and we are able to attack advantage basketball, it gets back to me, I can maybe make something more happen with it there. And then you start blitzing and he sees every pass and can make all of them and can make passes that you don't see, like that Manu Ginobili kind of something out of nothing quality. He has shown all of that now. If they get the doors beaten off of them in five games, we're probably not going to remember that. We're going to remember, like, this is the Celtics proving that they were, in fact, the most dominant team all season long. And that 64-18 and historic margin of victory and historic net rating, that none of that was a fluke. That was all for real and deserved to be treated as such. And Tatum, I mean, yeah, like there's a way to look at it where you're like, shit, he wasn't the MVP of the conference finals. He's shot 44% from the field and 29% from 3-point range in this postseason. It hasn't felt dominant. There's too often those, you know, possessions where he's just like meandering and goes into a step back mid-range or long two that's like, why are you taking that shot at that point, that clock time in the clock, whatever. And like, he's still, but like, he's averaging more than 25 points, 10 rebounds and 5 assists a game, and like been the linchpin on both ends of the floor for the best team in the league. Like, at a certain point, whether it looks exactly the way you want it to from your ball dominant apex predator wing player or whatever, like, that dude's really friggin' good. And maybe maybe he's closer to 10th than to first in terms of like the best player in the league. But we have seen Tatum be the best player on the floor against Giannis Antetokounmpo teams, against Joel Embiid teams. We've seen him. He has cooked Dallas the two times that they've played this season. Yes, not the same version of the Mavericks that we're seeing right now, but I think 72 points in two games against that team. You know, like, he's capable of putting up crooked numbers and of controlling the game in that same way. Maybe I wouldn't bet on him to do it every game against Luka, but I wouldn't bet against him being capable of doing it. And with the supporting cast he's got and the questions that they might be able to make Dallas answer with their spacing, with their defensive comportment, the multiple guys they can throw at Kyrie. And then if you sort of disrupt the two man, like, make it all Luka, then you got a better shot at it, you know? Like, all of which is to say, it does feel like the big story we're going to have to start telling ourselves, especially over this next week off, is like, this is Luka versus Tatum for who's got next. And I don't know that that's necessarily right. This might wind up being much more about like, who gets up more threes and how's Kristaps Porzingis looking. Yes. But there's if nothing else, there both of these guys have put themselves in position to where with a big next couple of weeks, they can ascend to a different level in terms of their overall estimation, which is already pretty high.
Yeah. And it's not that it's not to denigrate Tatum. It's just
sure.
Luka is more of a, I mean, there's a graphic that came out today from Synergy of points created for teammates as the ball handler on an ISO pick or post during the playoffs. Luka, total of 270. Tatum, obviously less games played. Four games less played. But he's at 112. And Luka, 16.9 per game. Tatum, 8 per game. That's also a reflection of their roles, right?
Yes.
Luka's running everything. And Derek White is operating post-game crunch time possessions. And Drew Holiday's operating post-game crunch time possessions.
Which is a really good, like, and it's the thing that rarely comes up in discussions of Tatum. And I can be blinkered on this too. So I want to make sure that you, since you brought it up, like, would the Celtics as an ecosystem function as well if Tatum was more like a, I mm-hmm. need to have the 35% usage rate. I need to be the one taking all those shots. Like, if not for a, like, being the kind of player who is raises your floor by filling every gap, but is willing to also get off of it and create more space for Jaylen Brown, for Kristaps mm-hmm. Porzingis, the touches for Derek White, like being willing to get off of it and supplement and complement in the, some of those moments. If not for that, maybe the Celtics aren't so friggin' good overall. That maybe like that lens, I think maybe gets obscured somewhat when we get so focused on who is the alpha, you know, the individual number one top scorer, top creator. There's also the general like rising tide lifts all boats. And I think Tatum is maybe more of that kind of guy, though he's capable of, you know, pitching daggers himself.
You mentioned Porzingis.
Yes.
To me, he's the most, I'm going to say the most X-factory player of this series.
Sure.
Just being that we haven't seen the guy, one, and two, Dallas didn't have to cover as much real estate on defense with Rudy Gobert.
Yep.
And look, like there were plenty of times where Rudy Gobert was off the floor and Dallas still did fine. But as good as Naz Reid and as good as Karl Towns are, they aren't 7-3. And Porzingis' role in that offense when healthy, aside from his steady diet that he gets of those elbow nail touches where he just turns and fires over someone, which was definitely something that he didn't get enough of in Dallas and is absolutely part of the stuff that ended up pushing him out of the door in Dallas. Boston made sure they get him those touches, but also he was picking and popping and popping out to 30 every time versus there's more stuff that I think Minnesota has tried to do to keep defensive on their toes with what Kat and Nas do and what have you. He's just longer and he shoots from further. It's just a simple analysis of the space on the floor that I'm not saying it's something that the Mavericks cannot achieve, but because I think they can. It's just something that I think is the look that Boston traded two picks to go, like technically they traded Marcus Smart for two picks and then took those two picks and traded it to Washington for Porzingis. Like this is why you go get him, to add just the last final element and dimension of an offense that has Tatum and has Brown and has Derek White and has and has and has, that you want to get to the final stage and present the potential spaciest, largest, whatever challenge for a defense to overcome. Do you think Dallas has the ability to do that?
I think a ton of it just depends on how good Porzingis looks, right? Like, and especially on the defensive end, because I have a sneaking suspicion that Luke is going to want to take him out for a walk and say, like, let's find out how, like, you know, even if, and so the matchups are such a big part of this, right? Like the bet for Boston, and it's the one that they've sort of made all year, is like, you can't guard Porzingis with a wing because if you do that, then you got to put your center on Tatum or Jaylen Brown or Drew Holiday or Derek White. And there, I mean, there might be possessions where, I know Drew Holiday, we've talked before, like, can be kind of a trick or treat postseason player. If his shot's not going, it might embolden you to hide somebody on him, see if, you know, he's not as good a screener or, you know, sort of secondary partner in that way as Derek White is. So like maybe there's, you know, some gambits there, and you see Daniel Gafford or Derek Lively on Drew Holiday. But generally speaking, you got to play us straight because there's no other place for your center to go. And the flip side of that is that we can, if we want to, we can put Porzingis on your least threatening guy. You know, I don't know, stash him on Derek Jones Jr., stash him on PJ Washington. Make those guys, if you want to hunt Porzingis, make those guys come up and be the screener. Dallas has been pretty comfortable with letting those guys set screens, but it can you know, muck up their spacing and you know, because you saw you have a non-shooting center then somewhere, and you got to figure out where, you know, where does Boston, is that going to embolden Boston to help off, whatever, yada, yada, yada. Either way, I would expect no matter who is guarding Porzingis, they're going to set some screens for Luka, maybe some for Kyrie, but Luka is definitely more of the, you know, matchup hunt, switch, you know, search and destroy kind of guy. And we'll find out if Porzingis is able, if the calf is healthy enough for him to, you know, move his feet on the perimeter, hold up out in deep water. And if he can't, if it's not looking good, if he's not able to move quite as well, then maybe he doesn't get to play as many minutes. And that's a huge win because, as you said, the way he can impact the game, it was the argument for Chet Holmgren to some degree in the second round. Like, well, if Dallas wants to you know, try to switch the pick and rolls, if they want to try to, you know, Chet's going to get pick and pop three. He's going to get a steady diet of them. And Dallas was like, A, go for it. We're not worried about you making as many of them. And B, we think we can get out there fast enough to contest them. Porzingis is bigger. He's better as a better shooter. He's a higher volume shooter. He's a faster shooter. And he's more willing to fire against a closeout. Just like, you're running in my face. I do not care. I am letting it go. And so those possessions in the Oklahoma City series where Chet Holmgren would like see somebody running at him and take, you know, pull it down and make the next pass or pull it down and try to drive into that shell, Porzingis is going to let it rip and is able to make those. And is also, as you said, the spacing is further out, so the rotation is longer. And so if he either pumps and goes and beats it, then he's downhill and there's more space to go into, or it's just harder for you to get out to him. So I think Dallas is capable of covering some of that ground. I think they're going to have to just say, if we don't, like, that we're going to make you prove you can make those shots against us. And we're going to make you prove you can defend well enough to stay on the court in this matchup without getting torched, because we believe that we're going to get good shots pretty much every time down the floor. And you're going to have to outscore us to do it. And we don't think you can do it. So I think that's kind of the chess match there. Porzingis, to me, I think you're absolutely right, is probably the most interesting swing piece in the series. I think 39 days it'll wind up being between when he last played and game one. We don't know for sure yet if he's going to be available for game one. I think that, you know, the hope in Boston is that he will be, but we don't know that for sure yet. It's a long layoff. It's a lot of rust to knock off quickly, and it's a dangerous opponent to try to do it against. But you're absolutely right. This is why they went and got Porzingis, was to become like an unsolvable riddle in this kind of matchup. I think it'll be pretty fun to watch Luka try to solve it.
Part of why they moved on from him was because of the injury concerns and not wanting to marry Luka to a number two that you wouldn't necessarily know if he was going to be there. So it's just interesting context as to him being out for all this run.
But also the point that you made about, like, Dallas moved on from Porzingis, or Dallas in Boston, Porzingis gets more of the touches that maybe Rick Carlisle didn't think he should have. Porzingis is just better at doing that now too. Like, he wasn't good at posting up the mismatches and anchoring down low and being able to create space to go. Like, he would get bullied down there, and now he doesn't. So like the failures that he had in those seasons in Dallas, and some, a lot of them was due to injuries, but like the shortcomings there helped him become the player he is now, who is better equipped to take advantage of those opportunities than he was when he was in Dallas. These guys, they get older, they use the lessons they learned, and they get better. And, you know, it can make it, could, it, it makes for an interesting sort of narrative arc. But I think, yeah, without, it's less like that he didn't have the chances and more like he didn't know what to do with them yet. And now he's got a new one. And you know, yeah, against the team that thought he was the missing piece. And now he could be the missing piece to keep them from doing it. Interesting kind of the way it all turns out.
Yeah. The other like X scorned partnership aspect of this is obviously Kyrie and Boston. And his tenure there ended more, I think, from his side of things first, as opposed to the team souring and having someone in place and blah, blah, blah. Of course, you know, very famously grabs the microphone at that season ticket holder event before the 18-19 season and says he's got every intention of signing there and has dreams of having his number 11 in the Raptors one day and his dad played at BU and blah, blah, blah. And then he's already caught on camera talking to Kevin Durant at All-Star break.
And two max slots. Yeah.
Two max slots. And Kyrie was even the one to further steer KD to Brooklyn as opposed to New York. And they'll say that they're brothers and they fought battles together and there's all love there. But there was absolutely a tangible tension between the young guns of Tatum and Brown versus the veteran guys of Kyrie and Gordon Hayward. So I think I'm going to write a little bit more of a retrospective of like why those situations, both KP in Dallas and Kyrie in Boston, didn't work out on the doorstep of all this. But I don't think there's much more to say other than Kyrie has always been maximized as like the most elite possible number two. With LeBron in Cleveland, that was what he was supposed to be in Brooklyn and what he was doing in Brooklyn before he got hurt. That's what he's doing now. That wasn't really the circumstance in Boston. Like, you go.
No, just, but I think that was like, if you are plotting all this stuff out in terms of the arc of somebody's career, like the whole point of him going to Boston was for him to see if he could be that guy. Like,
yes,
he was bristling under the sort of restrictions such as they were, and the idea that like no matter what you do in Cleveland, it's LeBron's success and you're just sort of the wingman for it.
For sure.
And to be in your early 20s, have already hit the big, what will likely wind up being the biggest shot of your career and won a championship and, you know, made All-Star, made All-NBA, max contract, like you've climbed to the top of all of these mountains. So then it's like, well, where do you go from here? What do you do next? You strike out on your own to prove that you can be your own man. You can lead the team. There's an image I continue to have in my head of the series, well, the Bucks-Celtics series, and Giannis is just like breaking through the wall. Like they're that much vaunted, like Al Horford, but wings on the side, the wall in transition, keep Giannis away. And there's a point, I forget which game in that series, but Kyrie waves everybody off and is like, I got Giannis. And Giannis destroys him, like absolutely, you know, like blitzes through him, gets to the rim. But it was like that experiment, that was Kyrie, you know, to some degree, Kyrie being like, I need to learn, or I want to learn how to lead. I want to do this myself. And one of the things that he came away from that with was like, it sort of thawed the relationship with LeBron eventually, because he was like, yeah, this is hard. It's harder to do this than I thought. And, you know, we're trying to sort of trying to get guys on board, figuring out how you do that in a way that is responsible and additive to young players, all that kind of stuff, showing them the way, the ropes, when you yourself are young in your career, all that kind of, like, he's, what is he, 25, 26 at that time? Not that he's
he's 32 child now. In this situation.
Yeah, so like 2017, 2018 in Boston, yeah, 6-7 years ago. There's a lot still to learn before you can start handing out life lessons at that point. And what goes on from there, you know, the circumstances sour in Boston. He goes from, yeah, like, I would love to be back here if you'll have me, to, I think the quote was, I don't owe anybody in about 4 months. And then, you know, I was at the Ringer at that time. There was a pretty heavy Boston focus at that point. There was a lot of a pretty big microscope put on Kyrie's comments and the ways that they shifted. The Brooklyn experience goes, I kind of don't even know how to talk about the Brooklyn experience because so
you
much
don't
of
have
it.
To.
No, but I'm just like so much of it was he did not want to get vaccinated, and there was a vaccine requirement in New York City, and he did not. He was not able to play in the games, and an awful lot of people thought that that was a principled stance that made sense. A lot of people did not. He became a hero in some capacity for it. He became a villain to other people for it. Then there is the link to the film, which led to a whole new set of hero villain stories about that. And kind of no matter what you say about what you think Kyrie Irving has done, there will be a segment of people who think that you are an idiot for arguing against him. And there will be a segment of people who think you are an idiot for supporting him. The basketball component to this is he has been able to stay on the floor more, you know, more often over the last few months than he has in many years. He has done everything he can possibly do to be that complimentary player rather than needing to show that he is the leader and the one who carries the most weight. He is perfect next to Luka Doncic, and every teammate he's got, which is also oftentimes true in Boston and in Brooklyn, swears by what he gives them and how the way that he can elevate them, you know, and put them in the right positions to succeed and to grow. Your mileage may vary on all of that, whether you think this is Kyrie Irving, like some sort of redemption arc for him, or whether Kyrie Irving does not deserve flowers for like growing up or whatever. Like there's a lot of ways to view it. The on-court story here, though, is that was arguably, I mean, I guess the nadir of his career to this point is I'm not playing because of a pandemic. But there's been some, you know, there's been some low points. The Boston period was certainly a low point. This is an opportunity to, whether you call it right some wrongs or, you know, expunge some, you know, exercise some old demons or whatever, there is a tidiness to him going back and playing against those guys whose yeah. growth he was part of, and being able to maybe show what the goal, what the hoped for result was for him while he was there, but that maybe he could never actually quite have produced yes. in the role he had in that set of circumstances. We also didn't even talk about the fact that the whole idea was Gordon Hayward is the number two guy there. And then what, 6 minutes into his career there, shatters his leg in one of the most gruesome on-court injuries you're ever going to see. And then nothing's the same after that either. Like that, all of these things have gone through like dramatic, traumatic, weird ass shifts for him for the last half dozen years. So for him to be back at this stage in the role he is now, you know, persona, you know, grata in Dallas, and you know, having elevated that team, like it's an interesting set of circumstances, and I think the people of Boston are not going to appreciate it very much.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was taking it. Like, I don't think it's necessarily a black mark on Kyrie's career that he was not able to take the baton of the Celtics franchise as he wanted to, as the expectations were. There also was a whole idea that like Anthony Davis was coming after too.
Right.
And there was a bigger plan in place and what have you. I just wanted to note that the contrast of everything he was hoping to achieve in Boston from like a leadership standpoint, from a finding success post out of LeBron's shadow standpoint, he has ironically found in Dallas, and now he has to go fully take advantage of it back in Boston where it didn't occur. To your point about Gordon's injury and other things, like the context is so much larger than just like Kyrie in one angle failed to do that. It just, the situation ran amok and things happen. Things happen all across the league. You could write a salacious intelli expose on drama behind every single team around the league right now. That's just how the NBA works, with so much money involved and livelihoods at stake and legacies on the line and what have you. It's just like a delicious irony that everything he wanted to find in Boston, it took him a disastrous outcome in Brooklyn to then end up in Dallas, kind of in a similar situation where no one really knew what Tatum and Jaylen Brown were at the time of his arrival in 2018, but it was supposed to be a similar thing to what he's doing with Luka.
Yeah.
And he's doing it with Luka.
I just want to, I want to go back because I found this from something that I had written. I'm not going to read my own writing because that would be pretty masturbatory. So I don't want to do that, but I'll read what Kyrie said. This was in the February of 2019. So he's still in Boston. It's right ahead of the trade deadline there. But before, you know, like he's got to figure out what he's going to do in the offseason. He says, is it a media? I think it was at the Garden. It was a shoot around before a Knicks game. He said, quote, at the end of the day, I spent the last 8 years trying to do what everybody else wanted me to do in terms of making my decisions and trying to validate through the media, through other personnel, managers, anybody in this business. And I don't know anybody. So for me, I think the confidence I have in myself and my abilities, I want to be able to control what I want to control. And
did he say that?
This was February 1st, 2019. Wow. And so after that, it's the move to Brooklyn. It's the Harden deal. It's the pandemic. It's everything that comes after that, right? It is a real journey in terms of that exercising that control, trying to blaze your own trail and establish what you know, your own individual identity in that way. A lot of people are going to have a lot of feelings about what that journey has been like and, you know, who it's benefited and who it's hurt and et cetera. But Kyrie got to that point where he was like, this is my opportunity to figure out where I need to be and what I need to do. And yeah, to your point, it is maybe being the best number two we've seen or the most perfect complementary superstar capable of scaling up or scaling down on or off the ball. You know, he has found his level and it has made Dallas a championship contender.
That's all we've got for you today. We'll have plenty more final stuff coming in the days ahead, the week ahead on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Before we go, just a quick mention and just it was a sad week from one respect of losing Bill Walton on Monday. And then the news out of Portland where Drew Gordon died in a car accident. I just spoke to Drew like a month ago for my Nikola Jokic, Aaron Gordon story. And if Denver had advanced, there was definite plans to say hello in person. So really, like truly a really good dude, Bill Walton. Obviously, there's been a lot of ink spilled this week. I read something, Ben Roebuck read something. I mean, plenty of other people from Bob Ryan to whoever has written. I mean, go look at Dave Pasch's tweets of all of his texts with Walton. There's a lot of gold there. So just to say, as we head out, live your life to your truest, listeners of the NC Armada. Set sail on any waters you want to, because you never know how much you got. And if there were two people in the NBA that I've interacted with that definitely embodied authenticity and just living your days to your fullest and your fullest self, it was definitely those two guys in much different respects, but they will be missed. And just wanted to say that before we get out of here.
Yeah. Our condolences to the, you know, the Gordon and Walton families and the people that they, you know, whose lives they've touched, and they're, you know, everybody who's hurting behind those things this week. It's 33 years old for Drew Gordon is an absolute sin.
He has three kids. It's sad.
Yeah. There's no good way to move from that outside of just, yeah, tell somebody that you love today that you love them and love on your people while you got them, for sure.
There you go. I love you, man. Love John Gennaro. Love all our listeners. Thanks to John for all he does to make the show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening and we appreciate it. If you came back again next week after game one, our No Cap Room will be recorded close to Friday morning, late Thursday night after.
In the wee small hours, yeah.
I will probably be somewhere in TD Garden as they're...
It's unclear exactly where I'm going to be. I might be in a conference room somewhere in Midtown Manhattan. We don't know yet. The point is, it's going to be very exciting, and we're going to be talking about game one of the NBA Finals. So come back and join us, won't you?